Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So today, I'm giving a talk on what in Zen in particular, Buddhism, but Zen in particular, we call form. And forms are really just the established way that we are kind of our customs and traditions, the established way we do things when we're together, particularly, and particularly with our bodies. They're usually like physical things that we do. Now, in terms of, if you look up definitions of form in the dictionary, this is the one that is closest to what we mean by form, is the manner or style of arranging and coordinating parts for a pleasing or effective result. So a lot of times, you know, I don't think we're very familiar with that definition of the word form, but it's a custom or a tradition, established way of doing something that is done that way for a particular pleasing or effective result. So some synonyms are behaviors, procedures, rules, manners, method, and practice. So the word isn't, so not surprisingly, it's related to the word formal, which means being in accord with the usual requirements and customs or conventional or marked by form or ceremony. So some synonyms of formal are ceremonial, explicit, precise, proper, and solemn. So generally a form is meant to be enacted with a certain amount of careful attention and dignity and respect for the tradition itself or for the people or objects involved. So some examples of form that you will have encountered this morning. And some of them are like, you know, traditional Zen forms that could be thousands of years old. And some of them are more adaptations where we're trying to keep the spirit of our practice alive in a particular setting. So I like to think that the first form we observe when we come into the Zen center is trying to not let the door slam behind us. Our particular door, if you don't, like, you know, put your hand on it, will go bam, you know, and shake the building. So, you know, kind of as we first come in, the first thing that we do, all right, I'm arriving at the Zen Center, I'm opening the door, I'm, you know, letting it softly close. Then we don't wear shoes in our meditation hall, which is traditional. So then we put our shoes somewhere outside, and ideally you put your shoes neatly side by side and you line them up with everybody else's shoes so that when, if you were to arrive at a Zen center, a Buddhist place, but particularly a Zen center, because we do this, I mean, you could walk in their front door and you would know the state of the Zen center by how the shoes were arranged. You know, if the shoes were all just arranged like this, you would just be like, you know, these folks really, they're really serious, you know. And you go in and it's like, you know, shoes all over the place. Now this brings up the kind of tension and awkwardness about form, which is we have this kind of tradition or ideal that we share with one another, and, you know, you're not blamed for not knowing the forms when you first come, right? But then there's people who, you know, you might be really interested in learning all those ways. You want to learn all the ways for one reason or another. Maybe it's just so that, you know, you're accepted and you don't make any mistakes. Or maybe it's because you find them kind of beautiful or inspiring. But then there's plenty of people who are, you know, all right, you know, kind of study them or apply them to a certain point, but then, oh, come on. And they're just being a little anal and uptight with all this stuff. So there's, you know, people have different reactions to all of this formality. And we're fine with that. We understand not everybody is going to take to it naturally. But if you, so there's that tension between knowing what this form is and trying to fulfill it in a way that is respectful, and being too uptight about it. Because definitely you could get too uptight about it. And so that's one of the reasons why, I mean, believe it or not, I don't know, have no idea what your impression is, but believe it or not, we're a pretty informal sangha. It's pretty just like, whatever, you know, you want to do the bows, don't do the bows, whatever, you know, just like follow along or whatever. And I really do that because I want people to feel welcome. It's a big enough deal just to come to a Zen center for the first time without having a sense that, like, if you bow the wrong way or something like that, people are going to be like, ah. So I try, I don't want to, perpetuate that kind of relationship with it, that it's strict or that there's an in and an out. Now there's people who know how to do it. And you're going to be obviously one of the people who don't know how to do it or something like that. So that's not why we do any of it. So that's kind of why I want to talk about it today. Well, why do we do these forms if it's not about, I don't know, that kind of uptight aspect of things? And I'm kind of like, my talk is going to be a little bit disorganized today because I started the morning. I did a podcast episode on this quite a while ago, Zen Forms, Customs and Rituals and Why They Matter. And I went through these different relationships that you can have with form. But then I thought, you know, I don't know that people are really going to get it unless they see where the forms came from. So then I really wanted to get it together to be able to show you a video. I now have a projector and I could have put it on the wall, but I'm missing the wireless LAN adapter that I didn't know I needed until this morning because we don't have Wi-Fi here and all this kind of stuff. So I was trying to do all this tech stuff before I came, which was ridiculous. But because there's this, which I'm going to get it. I'm going to get the adapter and we'll do it another Sunday. But is a half an hour video called Life of Zen. And it shows these monks, I think it's at Eheji Monastery, and, you know, they're doing this, just their whole life is form. Every single moment of their day, what they wear, how they move, how they eat, how they wash their face, how they go to the bathroom, everything is done according, it has a form to it. And so this video takes you through that, you know, in this beautiful, poetic way. And there's, you know, it's just beautiful, all these monks doing, you know, they're washing their faces in the morning and they're processing silently to chanting and all this stuff. It's not in modern lay practice that, you know, we're not even trying to make that happen. We can't make that happen. But when you see in a way, that's like, in some senses, the monastic form, which has been a big part of our tradition, is like what we're trying to do in spirit embodied. So it's kind of like the monastic form is what physically manifests and embodies the spirit of what we're trying to do all the time. So in regular life, we can't have as much form, right? I mean, we have to just kind of wing it most of the time. What's coming up? What's, you know, what do we need to do next? But we still can have some of these forms that remind us of the spirit that we want to have with the rest of this. And what is that spirit? And I guess the best way to describe it is that monastic form where, you know, Dogen from 750 years ago wrote these elaborate essays on how to wash your face and how to move in the study hall and how to go to the bathroom and all these things, and how to eat and all these, because the message is everything matters. Every moment of your life matters. How you treat everything matters. And again, that matters in a very sincere and loving and alive, appreciative way, not matters as in somebody's going to keep track and, you know, give you demerits for. So it's not a matters as in we've got to get all wound up and anal about, like, oh my God, I'm not doing this right. It's just that, you know, it matters how we approach everything. And these forms help us, they help us remember that. They're almost always require us to be more careful and thoughtful than if we didn't use the forms at all. So when we come in and we like, all right, you know, it's much easier just to like, you know, throw your shoes down or take them off wherever. It's another thing to, you know, put them straight. And it's even, there's almost in our tradition, this is where a lot of the teaching is meant to happen. We don't do koans. It's about this kind of manifestation according with the Dharma with our bodies. And it can go, there's always more subtlety to it, so you can never get it perfect. Because it's not even just putting your shoes straight. There's also, not that I'm suggesting you need to worry about this, but, you know, in a monastery, you put your shoes in order of seniority as well. And you also, like, what's the most convenient place to take off your shoes? What would be the quickest, easiest thing for you? Probably want to avoid that place. And leave that space for others. So there's also, like, a communal aspect to it, that you're paying attention to how your use of resources and your movements and your decisions impact everybody else in the community. So it's an awareness of everybody else as well. I'm just going to kind of list off some other reasons why form can be so, and let me just describe a few more forms just so that you have more of a sense in your mind about what I'm talking about. So I already talked about don't let the door slam, you take your, put your shoes straight. In a sense you could even say there's a form in the fact that we have a donation box out there. That was just, you know, we're not going to charge for anything, but we say, you know, please, you know, we need support. And so there it is. And so you might consider, have you given some support to the Sangha lately or something? So there's a donation box. Then you add, as you enter the Zendo, you might make a, you might make just a small standing bow to the altar. If you're going to come to your and if you're going to cross the center of the room, walk in front of the altar, yeah, it'd be much easier just to go like this, right? But you just thoughtfully, as you're whenever you're passing this midline of the room, you stop and bow to the altar. And bowing, all this bowing is a form. What is that about? I know I was really weirded out when I first started sitting, and I was kind of getting into all of this, right? I like the meditation part, I like the teaching part, and I was like, I don't know what all this other stuff is about, but I don't know. The other stuff's useful, so I might as well check this out. So I just started looking into it, but I mean, most of us have a Judeo-Christian background, and going to statues is, like, pretty uncool, and so I remember I got one of those little Hote statues, and I put it in, like, very weird. But we get used to it. You know, it's a sign of our aspiration. I mean, I personally, like, I don't even care if Shakyamuni Buddha ever actually existed. I certainly don't believe that he was some kind of deity or had supernatural powers or something, even though some of the scriptures say he did. This is it's a symbol of my aspiration. It's a symbol of the tradition that has given me so much. It's, I don't know, can't even really put your finger on it sometimes about why do we do this? But that's where another aspect of this is getting out of our heads and into our bodies. So this is a body practice. So in a way, I can give you all kinds of mental explanations for, like, oh, then you're about a direct person, and keep it in mind. And yet, when you think about it, altars are a completely natural thing. All cultures, all throughout time,
if there's something special, you find it a clean, elevated place, and you put it up there. Mm-hmm. Most of you have some kind of altar on your mantle with your family photos on it, or, you know, that's where you put something that you want to honor and remember. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there we have it. And then we have these traditions where, like, there's a candle on the right, there's flowers on the left, there's some incense offering, and as you kind of clue into that form, anywhere you go in the world, when you see a Buddhist altar, you'll recognize it. Anywhere you go, you'll think, you know, and you'll want to go like this, because you know what it is. I was in grad school, and I had a altar in my bedroom, and my housemates weren't Buddhist or anything, but my housemate was taking a friend through the house, and I think he was from Southeast Asia, and he saw my altar, you know, and he knew. And she was surprised, you know, just like some pretty stuff on a shelf or something, but he knew it was an altar. So that's another example of form. If we're going to come to our meditation seat, we approach from the inside. The middle row is a crapshoot. I mean, you know, there really kind of would be a middle row, but on the sides, we approach from the inside, and we bow to our seat. And again, all this bowing is about like gratitude, mindfulness, slowing down. I mean, you could just come in and just, you know, you could just sit down. But you're taking a moment to say, I'm grateful that I have this place to sit. And then you turn clockwise, and then you bow to the Sangha. I'm grateful that there's a Sangha here to sit with. And then you sit down, and why do we, there's little reasons behind all of this. Why do we approach from the inside? Which, you know, if I had my video, I could show you the monks on their tong. So they live in a hall with raised platforms, and they meditate, and they sleep in the same place. So this is when their whole lives, and they have a cupboard at the end of a one tatami mat's worth of space, 6x3, and they sleep there, and they keep all their stuff in the little cupboard. And you wake up in the morning, and you take your blanket off, and you go right into meditation. So the idea is that, you know, their whole life is meditation. You sleep in a particular position, and you wake up, and you go immediately into meditation. Your whole life is in the meditation hall. So, I mean, we keep those little aspects of the form as a kind of connection to this longer tradition. You know, then we might sit down, and we've done the chanting, which obviously that's an elaborate form. There's, you know, reasons why we do particular chants, and, you know, another aspect of this is letting go of personal preference, which is, you know, part of what our practice is about is letting go of attachment to self. And honestly, working in a being in an environment where you don't really get to choose how things go, or what we're going to chant, or what we're going to do, or whatever, and just noticing what your reactions are, and not being too troubled by them, is a great practice for the rest of life, frankly, right? How often do things go exactly the way we want? So there's a way that we can learn to just, there's a recent book by Geshe Greenwood about her experience in monasteries in Japan, and the name of it is Bow First, Ask Questions Later. And there's an aspect of it where you're like, you see, you can't bow if you are angry. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just it physically it's very, and you know, so there's this physical aspect to it, which that informs us, and even if there's not necessarily an intellectual understanding to go along with it, there's a, you know, that informs us. I lost my thread there, but another form is the degree of detail that we take care of in the altar and in the zendo and any of our spaces where we can. And I know that some people think that I am just being anal when I come and I straighten the cushions afterwards, after we all clean up.
And some people are just like, oh, I don't know. I straightened the cushions and it's still not good enough. She's still over there, like, you know, fussing with them. And I mean, yeah, I tend to be a little OCD in life, right? So this meshed very easily with Zen forms. but there's also like a, I don't know, this level of, when I guess I'm not doing it because, I don't know, why am I doing it? I'm doing it because I love the idea of, even when we're not here, just everything is beautiful. Everything is straight and beautiful and ready for the next time anyone comes into this space. And when somebody comes into this space, when things are straight and organized and aligned and clean, that indicates care. That indicates recent attention. So that's one of the reasons why altars will have live flowers on them. Because you can tell if somebody, you know, recently or visited an altar 6 months ago, the flowers are going to be all shriveled up, right? So that indicates that, you know, we are taking care of this immediately. So, you know, I'm like, you know, at the end I'm looking up and down the rows. There's black tape on the floor to align the cushions. And they should be pulled up to the tape, but you shouldn't see the tape. Are you coming over here? That's a very nice straight row right now. And that's the tape. And these little chant cards. I mean, this is where somebody's going to approach their seat, right? So if they approach their seat and the chant card is facing them, so then they can be right in the middle, so they wouldn't do this. Right in the middle. Then when you're done sitting, even before, you know, we leave the, we all stand up and we're going to go out and have tea, you know, then there's this process of you, even if you're not trying to look dirty, coming it off, and then these little zafus, pop them off, you know, with anything else straight. So then, you know, the next person who comes is all ready for them. So the list of forms goes on and on and on. And any of you who came to our session, our out-of-town session, know we have, you know, the eating, the elaborate eating ritual, which, you know, many people, it takes some getting used to because there's so many details to it that it can be stressful. but on the other hand, you know, how, you know, it's this, any of you hadn't seen it, it's a nesting set of bowls and they're all wrapped up with cloths. And we do a meal chant, and at a certain point, you unwrap your bowls and you fold the cloth into this little rectangle, and you take out your utensils in a particular order, and put your bowls, and then the food comes and you serve yourself. But I mean, when else have you paid that much of attention to eating? It just, you know, it makes it all like, now we are eating. And people will, frankly, the food does not have to be that great at retreat for people to think it's really great. Because they'll, you know, you've just been meditating for hours and, oh, you know, now you're finally eating and you're paying attention to the food in a way that you never would have before. So there's some aspects. I think there's another aspect where, in terms of these traditional forms, to some extent, I mean, they're good for mindfulness, they're good for cultivating appreciation, they're good for community harmony. Like, we're all doing the same thing together, and we recognize it. And so, ironically, you might find this a strange idea, but the more strict and elaborate the form, to some extent, the more inclusive that group is. And what I mean by that is, this may seem kind of, you know, why do we do this long chant around or not of all the ancestors and stuff? But when I have a chance to play you that video from Japan, you realize, you know, there is this monastery full of monks chanting, you know, they're chanting the same stuff we are. It's all in Sino-Japanese. They don't do the English, but we're just doing English versions of what they do. One of the forms you may have noticed was the, after one period of meditation, those of us who have taken some kind of vows, the precepts or a lay discipleship or a monk, put our robes, if you will, on our head, and we say that verse. Dai sai geira puku. And then, you know, how great the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. So we're essentially taking our vows again before we put the robe on. So usually we sit for a period of meditation first. My teachers would say that's like you're deciding again to take your vows. You're getting your mind clear and you're taking your vows again. And then I chose to have us say, so you recite that three times, and I chose us to have that say the first time in Sino-Japanese. And sometimes people will be like, oh, we're not Japanese. And that's true, which is why we do the second two in English. But you will learn that. And when I play the video, and you see all those monks putting their robes on their head, you're going to hear them saying, Dai sai geira pu, and you realize that we're doing the same thing. So there's a way that the consistency of the form connects us across groups and through time, you know, by keeping these traditions. And there's, by surrounding ourselves with this stuff, some of it you may like and some of it you may not, there's another aspect of it where you're kind of imprinting on it. It's the environment in which you are conducting your practice. And at some point, sooner or later, hopefully, you will have a sense of just the preciousness of life just as it is. You know, just drinking a cup of tea and seeing the, you know, the steam rise up from the tea, and you're just alive and you can take that next sip of tea, and this is just a miracle even to be alive. And in a way, like all of these forms and teachings and our meditation and stuff can bring us closer to that. And then we realize, like, there's nothing holy. There's nothing more holy about an altar than a cup of tea. There's, you know, we can have this attitude of care and preciousness with everything in our life. So there's a certain sense of which you'll realize, like, forms don't matter, you know, because everything can be precious. But then, because you have developed in the context of this form, it's kind of like an elaborate mnemonic device. This becomes familiar. So I'm not even, I mean, honestly, some of you have heard me say, chanting is not my favorite thing. It's not my favorite practice. Sometimes I find it hard to pay attention. But if I am on my deathbed, please come and chant for me. Please come and chant the Heart Sutra for me. I mean, this affects us. It's not just at a conscious level. We're doing this stuff. Even as we bow, we may not, really be thinking like, oh, my aspiration, and I want to keep my aspiration. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be mental in order for it to have an effect on us. That we have done this so many times, we've done this together. This is the kind of thing we do when we're together and we feel supported when we're together. And then it's just, that becomes family or home, or, you know, it's something very familiar that can be very supportive for us. Let's see. And I think, yeah, just I guess one more thing. In terms of the creation of Sangha, so I covered this a little bit as well, but whatever our relationships to form, our willingness to conform is a gesture that we can make to belong to Sangha, to create this group, to create this sense. Now, honestly, I was a pretty religious nonconformist before I got to Zen. I once told my husband, previous husband, if I ever get involved in an organized religion, shoot me. Because my idea about conforming was to give up one's intelligence and will, to lack creativity, to huddle together like sheep out of fear. You know, conforming was like a weakness. Conforming was a short way out. But then, you know, in exploring this at one point, said conforming meant to act in accord or harmony with a standard or norm. So accord or harmony. That was like, huh. You know, my religious nonconformism didn't have anything to do with that. What about according and harmony? When we do want to make connection and move together as a group. And I always just imagine, you know, what if we just opened the Zendo on Sundays and you could arrive anytime, which you can arrive anytime. So we're pretty flexible on that. You can arrive anytime and, you know, I mean, maybe you don't like seated meditation, so maybe you do walking instead, or maybe, you know, you prefer yoga, and so you could do some yoga over there in the corner, and, you know, maybe you know, what you really like is, you know, a philosophical discussion, maybe a couple people have a discussion over here, and maybe somebody just loves music, so they bring a guitar, and, like, we could all just come do spiritual stuff together for a period of time, you know, which would be cool, right? But I mean, how supported would you feel to come and meditate for 50 minutes? How likely would you be to do that if everybody else is just kind of like, eh, whatever? It's actually moving together, and I don't know if you guys found this, but you know, if other people are sitting still, I think of it as positive peer pressure. It's kind of like, I can't do this anymore, but like they're doing it, okay. You know, I mean, it's a kind of a positive level of support where if other people are able to do this, then we feel more able to do it. So I think in that sense, like the form is also something that we create together. And whenever you come, and to whatever extent you pay attention, to whatever extent you accord with the form, you are also supporting other people's practice. So thank you for doing that. All right, with that, I will open it to questions and comments.
I have a question. First of all, thank you very much for this talk. You know I am into this. And if you can't wait to see that video she's talking about, we do have a feature film sort of of the story of Dogen, which is not entirely accurate, but it's a good movie, and there's some interesting commentary by a couple of teachers at the end. But specifically, I saw that when I was in my first year here, and there is a moment about more than halfway through where they all say, "Daisai Geta Fufu." And I was totally blown away because here I was, I think by then it was about 2015, reciting the same thing that they cited and that they recited in the 12th century. 12th? 13th? I can't remember. But anyway, so that was very, talk about feeling like you're a part of the world. I mean, that was very...
And did you know Dogen's story about that?
No.
So his story, so he went, he studied Buddhism in China, I mean in Japan. He was a monk in Japan, but he wasn't satisfied. So he made the trip to China, which at the time was a very dangerous trip. And indeed, his ship almost went down on the way back. But he went and he traveled around to different places And it was when he was in a Soto Zen temple with his, you know, eventually his teacher. And when they did that, when they put the robes on their head, which he had never seen that done before, when they put the robes on the head and chanted, he just, his heart melted and he knew he was in the right place. So isn't that interesting that,
yes,
that you would feel that connection as well?
And it's such a goofy thing to put this up. But everybody does. But my question is, and I'm guessing this is more of how we are at Brightway versus how temples are in general, but what is your instruction on leaving the Zendo and coming back? Because some of us do that a lot. About bowing.
Yeah. Well, I would say, like, make that bow the first time you enter the Zendo for the day or the morning or the evening. So it's kind of like your first formal entrance into the Zendo. Then you need to go out and set up the tea cart. You need to get, you know, again, a lot of these forms, because traditionally you would bow in a very formal way every time you enter the space, but we wouldn't use the space for all these different things either. So they would have, you know, a meditation hall that you didn't do anything else but meditate there, and yet you have a chanting hall, a separate chanting hall. You don't do anything but chant there, and so. But we come and go so much, and we make the space when it's a talk or a class, it's fairly informal. So I would say, you know, that just that first time that you enter the Zendo, you do that. And then leaving, you would traditionally do it when you leave as well, and you can. But again, sometimes everybody's trying to leave at the same time. So, you know, just kind of for a practical sense, you can just, you know, leave the room.
So you had this talk on porn, but you never mentioned Zazen.
Well, and that's where, I mean, you could look at Zazen as one of our forms. When we talk about Zazen, you know, and as I don't know if it's all people, but certainly Westerners are like, well, what is it supposed to do with our mind? And why do we do it? And how is it supposed to feel? And, you know, so we talk a lot about Zazen and how to do it and all that, which there's an aspect to it of that, but really in a Soto, if you went to Japan and a Soto Zen monastery, mm-hmm. and sometimes they will like, oh, you know, thank you, it's nice that you are visiting us, I will give you Zazen instruction now. They don't ask whether you need it, they're just going to give you Zazen instruction. And then they tell you, you know, and you sit like this, and you know, your head's like this. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I mean, that's like, and then they say, you know, thoughts will come and go, don't worry about it. So there's an aspect in our practice where that is just another form. That is just another way that we thing that we do. I don't know why we're just sitting here, but that's part of, you know, that's our koan. All these forms are our koan in Soto Zen.
Kind of reminds me that maybe it was a psychologist or somebody who wrote that the way you do anything is the way mm-hmm. you do everything.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
and,
exactly.
And it's what you're talking about is a really good example of that, that each aspect of following form reminds you to do it mindfully. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I find that when I focus on form repeatedly, eventually it just disappears, like practicing the piano or learning some technique. So I would be losing my focus over time with that form.
Well, and that's where, you know, that's one aspect of it, but in a way it is a permanent aspect of it. And, you know, if we watch that video or you watch the video, you know, which I can tell you the name of it, you can watch it on YouTube, but, you know, it's just so beautiful and inspiring. It's this monastery and all these monks and they're moving and they're bowing and they're beautiful robes. And mm-hmm. and I think it was Suzuki Roshi who said, you know, because he trained there, and he was like, you know, after a while, like, we'd that's just, it's not special. It's not, it's just life. It's just, you know, from, it's only kind of from the outside, you're, oh, wow, isn't that special? But on the other hand, even though you lose that sense of kind of conscious specialness, you're still moving in that way. We're still bowing. We're still lining up. We're still according. So there's a way that sometimes I think of it for myself, like I'm so identified with what's going through my mind and my sense of myself and my sense of life and all that. And sometimes I think, what if I watched my life from the outside and I turned the sound off? And all I could see was what I do, not what I'm thinking, just what am I doing? And like that, in a way, that's more real than anything that's going on in my head. Yeah.
I think that places hold energy. So for me, form is a framework that I can step into for whatever reason, can call it comfort. About 5 years ago, a German documentary came out. It's called Into the Silence. Mm-hmm. And it's very quiet, very little dialogue. But I watched it with a friend who has a strict religious practice. She and I sat there and ate blueberries. But the whole rest of my evening was so calm. That human history validates that ritual has deeper levels of purpose.
Yes, into great silence, and you can, I think you can see it on Netflix or whatever. And it's like 2.5 hours of silence and watching these monks, these Christian monks. At I think it's the Chartreuse Monastery, just going about their daily lives. It's really cool.
It's amazing how similar the forms are. And we know that's no accident.
Yeah.
Because back in Alexandria, Egypt, all these different religions, the Christians, the Buddhists, the Muslims, they would join together and they would share their traditions. And so you could see, you know, the incense and the head shaving and the contemplative prayer. It's just, it's so amazing. Yeah, I was just trying to think of the name of that movie.
And then when we, you know, Richard's maintaining our altar, you know, always have it clean and aligned, you know, so everything is straight. And the little incense burner has 3 feet, and you put the single foot, that should be toward the front. And I haven't gotten this yet. There's little tools. For the inside, there's ash, and that's where we put the incense in. We don't burn much incense. We just put it out right away because people are sensitive to it sometimes. But the ash should be completely smooth. Like at the beginning, every time we're going to practice together, the ash should be just completely smooth, which is very difficult to do if you don't have one of these little tools, which are hard to find, but I'm determined eventually to get one, because at a training thing that I went to, there was a Japanese nun, you know, explaining how to, this is not an easy thing to do, even with the tool, like get this ash, if you sneezed, it would go all over, you know, and it has to be compressed or the incense won't stick in it. But not too much, because then the incense will go into it. And it's smooth, and then it will even, there's even ways you can take that little tool and you can even make little patterns in the ash. And like, that kind of, I don't know, this kind of support and care that is communicated, when I've, you know, done a lot of work to keep the Sangha together, and I show up and I come in and I put my robes on and I go up and I go to offer incense, and there's the ash all clean and ready for me to, you know, that's just, we're just supporting each other through those actions. And there's all kinds of, I mean, you know, and then form, we have people who come and they they open up the building before we all arrive. And so we have our own little forms as well, right? There's a tea cart, and it lives in the back room. And you roll out the tea cart, and you fill the water receptacle with filtered water that Mark brings from home, because the water that comes out of our faucets has lead in it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so we have that water that Mark brings, and then somebody puts it in there and plugs it in, and you also put the water thing not on the cart, you put it on the counter, because it's too easy when you're cleaning up to just roll the cart off while the thing's still plugged in, and then it falls on the floor and breaks. You know, so there's little thoughtful reasons why we do things here, this and there. Oh.
I remember Kyogen would always, he was notorious for straightening things out. Things on the altar weren't quite right. You get somebody new doing sacristy. And sometimes he would get visibly irritated, you know, and he would straighten people's shoes out sometimes if there's something hanging on the wall. He was always doing something like that. But he would roll, you know, he'd get annoyed because maybe somebody just wasn't taking that much care, and he could see they're not, you know, it's not showing that courtesy, I suppose, when you're not taking care. But he would really roll with the punches, too. And, you know, some of the forms are like when you started the talk, mm-hmm. you bow a certain way, and then everyone bows to you. And Kyogen did that, but I think whoever was ringing was supposed to come to come back and ring the gong was probably in the bathroom, so had some business to take care of. And so we were all upstairs, and he's about to do the Dharma talk, and he's like, "Where's the precentor?" I'm like, "Okay," so he just. He went up to the altar. He didn't want to wait anymore. And then he went, boom. You know, and then he turned around and everybody, boom. Like that.
Judith.
How does form change, or how should it change, if at all, when you move out of the practice hall or the meditation hall and into political activity?
Huh.
Not just your regular life, but...
Political activity. Well, first of all, I should say, in terms of bringing form into your regular life, I mean, obviously, you have to be flexible and adapt and you know, that's just kind of the nature of lay life. So even if you want to have, like, established ways that you do everything, it's usually very challenging. Like, you do it for 3 days, and then something comes up, and you can't do it. But you can do little things like, I'm going to say the meal verse before I eat. Or, I'm always going to pick up my teacup with two hands. Or, there's these little things that you can do throughout the day that serve the same purpose. It makes you take care. It makes you act in harmony. And it makes you, enacts consideration and appreciation. And now, how you would take that when you're engaging politically, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that this is kind of subtle. I don't know. This is kind of a form, I guess. But when I'm getting into an argument with somebody about who knows what, you know, we're starting to like, but, you know, I don't know. We should, you know, electoral politics, blah, blah, blah. And I just, like, I try to stop and take a breath and realize, you know, what is going on right here? I'm having a conversation with somebody. I'm not going to be able to, like, make them think the way that I think. I'm not going to change the world through this conversation. So, like, focusing more on the person that I'm talking with instead of the point that I hope to make and be right. I mean, I don't know if that's a form. That's kind of subtle, but I don't know. I suppose you could do something like, I don't know, you could say a little mindfulness prayer before you read the news. Or, you know, just like, you know, whatever is happening, I want to know, I try to keep my bodhisattva heart open, or something like that. So you can kind of be creative with whatever it is that helps you stay truer to your aspiration, even in the midst of all of that challenge. That's a very interesting question. Well, I guess I've kept you long enough. Thank you all for coming. Oh, and does anybody want to go out to lunch? Who usually does? The regular lunch folks aren't here. So. All right. Yeah.
I wanted to say that we don't have a closer today, so if anybody wants to...
If you want to learn the form of closing, you could talk to Shoketsu. And next week, Shintai wanted to tell me to tell you that her Dharma talk is going to be kind of a report on this Awakening to Whiteness class that we had recently. So she went through and a bunch of us went through. And so she said, you might think of it as like the Dharma of racial identity. Oh, and I should end the Dharma talk formally too. I'm sorry. I always forget that. See, because we've been informal, just like, whatever. Just see you later. Okay, so. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha.